Hi, I'm Jesse Driscoll. I'm here with Christian Davenport, and we're bringing you the Raiders of the Lost Archive. Archives are repositories of special information. Archives can take many forms: historical documents, oral histories, or data sets that can't just be downloaded. We're asking questions to allow some special guests to speak candidly about their research process. The conversations will be archived here for the social science community. Thanks for listening, and enjoy. Wendy, we typically let people introduce themselves the way they like to be introduced. So how would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is Wendy Perlman. I'm a professor of political science at Northwestern University, and I specialize on the comparative politics of the Middle East.
So what is the topic or question that you're interested in examining for the research project that you were going into the field to collect data on?
Yeah, well, I've done various research projects involving fieldwork over the years, but I guess I can focus on the project that I began in 2012, interviewing displaced Syrians about their political experiences. And I began with an interest in the question of what explains participation in high-risk protest. So this was in the months after the start of the Syrian uprising in the context of the Arab Spring. Syria is a tremendously repressive police security state, and many Syrians described the Syrian reality as one of fear, of co-optation, of degradement. And Syrians defied all that and went out and protested in huge masses, demanding change in this authoritarian regime. So I was fascinated in what it was that brought people to go out and protest despite the high risks, and thought that one way to find out would be to go talk to Syrians who themselves protested. And because it was really too dangerous to go inside Syria to do those interviews, I decided to interview those who had fled the country as refugees. So the Syrian uprising began in 2011, and my first field trip was in 2012, where I went to Jordan and basically tried to interview every Syrian I could about if they went out and protested, and if so, how and why and what that experience was like.
So I want to ask about your feeling. I'm deviating already from kind of what we talked about, but I want to ask about kind of like your thoughts regarding going to a location other than the spot where things were going down, and if that altered or shifted what you think you needed to do or know going into that archival space.
That's a terrific question. So, I mean, while there are and there have been over the years journalists who've gone on into Syria and done interviews there. I mean, it's just a tremendously dangerous space. It would have been dangerous for me to have sort of frank conversations about politics and dissent in an ongoing war. And also would have been unsafe for interlocutors to be talking with me and having these types of conversations. So although, I mean, I'm in awe of journalists who have gone into Syria, or Syrians themselves who in various ways do various types of research projects in both regime-controlled areas and rebel-controlled areas. For me, it was just something I never considered. There were a trickle of thousands, then became tens of thousands, and we now are millions of Syrians who fled the country. And I thought that was a tremendous resource. Let me take that back. I don't want to refer to Syrian refugees as resources, but in the context of talking about archives and data collection, which is, I know what you guys do, you know what I say when I refer to this as a resource and a repository of people's stories and experiences. So it was just kind of the only option that I thought to be safe and ethical under these really extreme circumstances. And in some ways, there might have been kind of a data collection advantage to it too. I mean, part of my reasoning was, although people were outside the scene of the conflict, that space of greater physical security, as well as kind of a political security, that they weren't under the watch of the security forces, the army, this political regime, kind of gave a space to talk and reflect that I think would have been quite difficult inside the country. So even the outside the scene could seem like a disadvantage or a distortion, also can open up opportunities, especially when you're dealing with conflict situations and authoritarian situations. But you're totally putting your finger on the fact that a researcher has to take this into account and has to know what is the context in which you're talking to people, and how does that shape what they say, what they don't say, and how they say it. But for my particular project, I think that context actually offered more opportunities than it would be otherwise. I'm doing it inside Syria.
So quick follow-up. So I did some stuff on forced migration with Will Moore and Steve Poe back in the day. But one of the reasons we kind of got into that project was I was talking about, talking to Black folk from the North, it might be probably different from the people that were in the South. I'm just like, because the people in the North fled, right, from like whatever was going on for whatever reason. And I always thought it was interesting. I'm just like, well, is there a kind of a systematic difference for those that stay versus those that go? And in the African-American case, it was like the folks that left end up being part of the Black nationalist movement largely, and the people that stayed ended up being part of the civil rights movement. So I thought that difference was very interesting. But I'm wondering about it, and I'm sure you thought about this, but I'm wondering about what you thought might be the differences in the group that ended up going that you interviewed versus the group that stayed, if any, with regards to their experiences or political awareness or anything like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, at this point, over half of the Syrian population has been forcibly displaced. We were a population of about 1.1 million, something like almost 6-7 million people are outside the country. Another 6-7 million are displaced within the country. So the forced displacement is just on epic, epic levels. When I was interviewing and starting in 2012, I went to Jordan, where the huge majority of Syrian refugees were from the southern province of Syria, which is where the uprising began. Which is also where the repression became most fierce, most quickly. So I was tapping into the very, very beginnings of the protest movement in that particular location. Another thing I think that's interesting is, especially in the beginning stage, most of the people I talked to did not even see themselves as refugees. They didn't. We've packed up everything. We are leaving the country and never coming back. The typical narrative I heard from people was, there are bombs falling on our heads, and we got out before we got killed, and we're going to go back any day now. Some people fled with nothing. Some people fled with something. Some people's families were split. But most people expected to go back anytime. They saw themselves as leaving a matter of miles or kilometers, sometimes to stay with extended family on the other side of the border, just to get out of harm's way. So, while there might be some systematic differences in those who decided to do that and those who didn't, one being a certain amount of resources is necessary to leave the country. But a lot of people were literally, walking and maybe paying for a smuggler, or walking just a matter of kilometers, really. But there's a certain number of resources needed to leave the country. I think that became more apparent in Syria with time went on, and there were more checkpoints and there were different groups and people had to literally bribe a million times before they got out. But at this stage, I don't think it was as expensive. And of course, maybe those who stayed to fight. Which it still was, still a little bit incipient in that part when I began, but men typically who stayed to fight were maybe different than women, children, or men who decided to leave the country. But all of this has really changed over the course of the Syrian conflict. So it was one reality in 2012, became something very different in 2014, 16, and now.
Yeah, so that is perfectly goes to my next question. It's kind of a two-part question. The first is, how did you make decisions about sampling and access when you first arrived in 2012? And then the second part is, how did that change over time as the conflict changed?
So my, thinking about sampling was, I'm going to talk to every single person I can, whatever I find them. And I hope that's a systematic scientific sampling frame for you. This is my first time researching Syria. I didn't have many contacts. I just wanted to get my feet wet. So the first trip was really pretty exploratory. I literally didn't know anyone. I hadn't done research in Jordan before. And I was new to Syria, having really focused on the Palestinian case for the previous decade or so. So when I first began, I essentially just was combing the internet for journalistic stories about Syrian refugees in Jordan that was still pretty, you know, early on population, essentially cold email everybody I found who had written a story on that. Some journalists, some NGO people, tried to have a few conversations. Two Jordanian journalists were very, very kind and generous to me. Said, oh yeah, get to Amman, we'll meet for coffee. And I met these two women for coffee. They immediately said, you should talk to this Syrian guy who's been something of a fixer for us, who's, or not a fixer, but has helped us connect to the community. And he goes by the name Abu Thayer, which in Arabic is like father of the rebel. So I met Abu Thayer that first week. Abu Thayer was my interview number one. And he kind of took me under his wing and introduced me to almost everybody he could think of. And for him, it was a political cause. It was early in the revolution. He wanted to get the narrative out. He saw documenting our stories and getting them out to the world was for him a political act. So he helped me in a way that he was motivated to do. And from there, and this is what I always sort of, you know, tell anybody thinking about fieldwork, basically it was an unending story of asking everybody I came across for favors. Hi, do you know anybody? Hi, do you know anybody? Hey, can you introduce me? Just following up. You said your cousin might talk to me. Hi, it's me again. Wondering if you could, if your cousin was really willing. I basically asked everybody I came across with in the hostel I was staying, and the cousin of somebody I'd studied Arabic with 20 years earlier, yeah, colleagues, friends of friends of colleagues of friends of friends. I just asked anybody, can you introduce me? Can you introduce me? And then, of course, every interview ends with, hi, thank you. Do you know anybody else who might talk to me? So it was a classic, you know, snowball sampling of trying to toss every possible snowball off every possible mountaintop and let it roll. And it just expanded and expanded and expanded. And you try, and you know that this biases the sample in certain ways, but by just trying to get every entry point you can, you hope that you get some diversity of folks. And then there were the sort of spontaneous things of you meet somebody to talk in a coffee shop and a friend walks by and then that opens up another door, or you meet someone in somebody's home and a neighbor comes by or a cousin comes by and one interview becomes 20. So one of the biggest differences over time is that my networks just became more and more expansive with each one branching in millions of directions I couldn't have even anticipated. And then also sort of branching out online. I mean, I now have hundreds and hundreds of Syrian Facebook friends who I've never met in person who came in contact with me one way or another. And some of those have become interviewees as well. So a major sort of biasing aspect for me is because I began really interested in the question of what explains participation in high-risk dissent. And I was introduced by one person who participated in protests or supported protests, moving to another. These networks that I built over the years, which are now like global in many different countries, are much, much, much stronger among those who identify with the opposition. I have tried over the years, because I went to Jordan and then I went to Turkey and I went to Lebanon and I spent 5 summers in Berlin and have done interviews on Zoom. So it's really become Europe, Middle East wide. And now I've done a lot of sort of remote interviews as well. It's become quite expansive. So there, you know, occasionally I end up talking to someone who is maybe a little bit more critical of the uprising. This has created a situation in which I primarily have researched those in the opposition, and it's harder to get to those on the other side. And that's a limit that I've sort of accepted. Hopefully other people research that and do it well, but these are the limits of, not firm limits, but general limitations on who I've been able to reach. And I think there's still an awful lot to say about that population. So I try to do it in depth and do it well.
We don't normally segue as well as I think we're going to right now. And this is great, by the way, so I'm very, very much enjoying it. But related to kind of like your last point,
yeah,
I'm curious how you feel your earlier research and reputation and network influenced this project. So like what you just said kind of suggested, it's just kind of like, oh, you're the resistance story woman, or the Palestinian background. I mean, it's just like there's, so I'm curious, And I find this question especially interesting in this context, because I'd say that the bulk of the people that we've done interviews with and had interactions with, they normally discuss like their first project. So it's really cool to talk to somebody a couple of projects deep to think about that. Well, it's not as if you talk to somebody and they're not Googling you immediately or trying to find out like, who the hell is this person that's cold calling me or whatever. And so what do you think about that?
Oh, that's interesting. So, I mean, the fact that I've done this earlier work on Palestine, I mean, it actually didn't come up so much explicitly. Maybe people were Googling me and they got to that. So that's possible. But it does give like, I mean, working in the context of a resistance movement in the Arab world, it could be seen as a bit of street cred, probably, with the Syrian folks I was talking with. But the truth is, there was a kind of Syrian street cred that sort of built, and that in part built when I started publishing things. So as I started writing, I think more people who identified with the Syrian uprising saw what became of this research project, and if they felt that it represented them and that it represented them well, and it was a project that was not, that they supported in some way, that totally opened the door. Once I started publishing, and then the book that I ended up writing in 2017 was published in Arabic and now is available online in Arabic, has also helped other people come. You know, I've had that now I have Syrians reaching out to me saying, I've read your work and would you like to interview me? I mean, so in some ways, or, you know, I like your work and just want to reach out and say that. So that has built. I mean, and also then once I started publishing and giving talks, for example, and did a lot of public talks on the 2017 book, there will often be a Syrian person in the audience who then comes up and says, the stories that you just told, the voices you just read, you know, that's me and that's my friends. And that then becomes an interview. Or there's a non-Syrian in the audience who says, you know, what you say reminds me of a Syrian friend of mine. Would you like me to introduce you? So that's I think the part of the reputation being built has come once there are products from the research that then circulate.
So for the people who are watching the video and are confused by the two finger thing, that's an academic silent signal that you want to ask a follow up question without derailing things. So following up on your discussion about how the sample changes when they could read what you're publishing.
Yeah.
I'm starting to notice that in my career as well. As I write on Ukraine, it really changes things a lot. And I want to use that as a segue to give you a chance to talk about what it is that you ended up eventually researching and publishing on. Because I have read and taught your We Crossed the Bridge and It Trembled, but I'm sure that many of the people who are listening to this are not familiar with it. So you can talk about how you pitch it to a non-specialist audience, which I'm sure you do all the time. But, you know, how did you come to talk about the research you were doing over time as well? Because I'm sure you didn't continue on with the costly collective action under peer, you know, whatever your riff was in 2012, I'm sure it changed. So how did you end up talking about what you were researching?
Right. There's a nice story about how that came to change. So that first summer, I basically was asking everyone, I mean, the translation I made in Arabic, both linguistically and sort of substantively, the question of what explains participation in high-risk protests? In the Syrian context, my question became, what does the expression breaking the barrier of fear mean to you? And if so, how did it happen in your old life? Because this was an expression that became super ubiquitous in the Arab world and in Syria, that people talked about the sort of eruption of the revolution as people breaking through the barrier of fear. So that was a way that I slowly discovered I could ask the question in a way that really resonated with people, and they got, and they had, that you could see in people, I could see in people's eyes that they were like, oh, let me talk about this experience. So that was, so that first summer, I basically went around asking everybody, breaking the barrier of fear. Did you break the barrier of fear? How so? How did it happen? When did it happen? What was it like? And I just kind of got addicted to recording people's stories. It opened up a door to talk about authoritarianism, to talk about protests, talk about all sorts of things. I came back.
Because I knew you from Middlebury. I know that you were asking that question in Arabic. So how do you ask it in Arabic?
Yani تعبير إن كسر حاجة الخوف إيش معنى بالنسبة لك شو صار إلك كيف صار كيف كسبتوا يعني حاجة الخوف is this air barrier of fear and it was كيف كسرت حاجة So the second summer, 2013, I came back. I had my first meeting with Abu Thair, my sort of main field contact. And he was like, that's great. What are you doing here the second summer? Like, why are you still here? And I was like, oh, I want to keep asking people about the breaking the barrier of fear and gather more stories about breaking the barrier of fear. And I remember he looked at me and he just like shook his head. And he was like, that was so long ago. You can't keep asking people about that question. Ask them about despair. And it was a huge wake-up call for me that where I was still in the mode that, you know, obsessed with the scholarly question of participation in high-risk dissent because we hadn't quite resolved it yet. It was still live and important for me. He was saying for Syrians, now 2 years later, now in a state of war, such severe repression and horror, people weren't thinking anymore about that joyous emancipatory moment of protest. They were thinking about being crushed and seeing their revolutionary dreams be thwarted. And at that point, I realized I could not keep asking that question. The Syrian revolution had moved on, and I started making my questions much, much, much broader. And from then on, slowly, I came to ask essentially one very different question. My interviews have become, I always say, two questions. One is, do I have your permission to record? And two, tell me about yourself. And they became totally open-ended stories in which people basically told me almost anything they wanted to tell me about this entire Syrian experience. So from that, I gathered lots of different material. I ended up writing a few articles about high-risk dissent and how it's both the emotions of how it participates and how people come to participate in terms of identity and other motivations, how participation is organized in initial stage of an uprising where there's not much by way of pre-existing sort of social and political institutions. So I end up writing a few articles about what I originally hoped to research, but I all ended up gathering data on things that were so much broader that talked about so much larger themes encapsulated in the Syrian experience of authoritarianism, uprising, and war, that I ended up writing a book that is something of a more of an oral history. That's a collection of interview excerpts or a curation of excerpts from these interviews that tries to walk readers through that whole story of what the Syrian conflict is about, how the uprising began, why it began, why and how it took the route it did, through essentially stitching together these direct voices that I recorded. And I did that because I ended up getting material that was much broader than just this narrow social science question. And because I had such sort of rich personal narratives, I thought that I ultimately came to see that the best way to showcase the material, what did best by the material, that the material need the format, the material needed to speak in its most powerful form, was really to let those go narrative forwards, let the voices in some way speak without me theorizing them and interpreting them, at least not in a heavy-handed, direct way. Now, as you know, a story doesn't get from a person to a tape recorder to a piece of paper to a book without the author having, you know, a very heavy role in the whole thing. I chose the excerpts, I stitched them together, I edited them, I made this book, but I wanted it to be a way in which I was sort of almost like a midwife presenting select material that was selected to tell a coherent story of wading through the tens of thousands of ums and distractions that any interview collection has to tell a story without me theorizing it, analyzing it, at least in a way that had my, you know, my voice telling a reader this is what it was all about. Instead, I'm saying I had had the immense privilege and joy of sitting down with all these people and learning from them. If you, reader, you know, had the free time I did to go trot around the world and talk to these people, these are the kinds of things that you would hear too. And here is the Syrian story told through their voices. Now, of course, there is a lot of subjectivity and choice in my role in all of that. But I've tried to do the best I can by way, you know, by the people I've talked to. And again, the response from many Syrians themselves has been quite telling. And that's then when people have said, you know, I think you got our story right.
This I'm not going to be able to get to all the questions that I want to get to at the moment, but which is a good sign. But I'm finding two things or two riffs I want to follow up on. One is this idea of and I think again we haven't really been Jesse and I haven't really gotten there as consistently with different people, but so we have what we broadly conceive to be an archive, which is anything from some old rotting paper to people in a village to satellite images. I mean, we're very open with that. And doing the archive justice is something that we haven't really gotten to explicitly or as explicitly as I'm going to get to now, because you have this collection of stories, experiences, narratives, whatever you wish to call it. And then we have you or us as the author or the collector or the curator or the midwife, as I think you called it, or the shepherd, and you consciously making this comment about doing your best to get out of the way and to not let the venue crush the thing. But it's not like you're just kind of like, yo, come to my webpage and there's 12,000 stories and click a button and play. So, you know, there is some curation to it. And so I find that to be a fascinating process. And this idea of, do you feel that you are, where does your midwifery come from? Do you feel, it's kind of like, I do the most justice by getting out of the way the most. What's your philosophy of midwifery? I mean, like literally I was kind of going there. So I'll stop at that one, cause I want to talk about staking claims in non-scholarly work early on in a process so that people can see which way you're going, or maybe you're sending a flag as to who I am or what I'm going to do with it. I'll get to that later, but go, please.
Yeah, this is, I mean, it's terrific. And I know that, like, you know, these interviews don't speak for themselves. As I said, I think of it like, I don't know if actually x-rays work that way, but an x-ray is something like, if you'd see a film, you'd see my fingerprints on every single aspect of this project, you know, from who I interview and how the interview itself proceeds with my personal style. An other interviewer might do something different. You know, the transcription, the translation, which of course translation itself is also an art, you know, and I'm paying other people to do the translation, but I'm sort of overseeing the process. And then there's editing of the material and selection of excerpts, because a single interview might be 20,000 words. And in the last book, I might have chosen 60 words from that interview that goes in order to showcase 85, in order to have 85 people have a large range of, so there's choice. There's my choice and my agency and my discretion at every single part of this process. So in some ways, I think me getting out of the way is not actually, I mean, I'm not out of the way in the process. I totally am in the process and I have my dirty hands on everything. But in thinking of the final format with what I wanted a reader to engage with, I didn't want them to engage with me, Wendy Perlman, explaining the Syrian uprising to them. Me saying, here are these, I did a bunch of interviews and that is data for me to analyze and interpret and tell you why it's important and what it means. and what explains. That I found that in these interviews, Syrians were explaining and interpreting their own experiences. They weren't just data for me to interpret and analyze. They were making sense. They were saying, and this is what our regime is like, and this is how it survives. And this is why we took up arms, and this is why we fled. Like, these are all social science questions. You know, what explains the militarization of protests? People were saying, this is why I took up arms, or these are why my neighbors took up arms. And I could use these as various data points to construct my own theory of militarization, or I could present a few Syrians saying, describing when they first saw people showing up with arms at protests and what their neighbors were doing. So that's what I meant by being sort of there forward. But yeah, I think anybody working in this realm of work has to recognize and be transparent about how heavy their role is in the whole process. And it can be dangerous because it can look as if that role is not heavy, because this is a collection of voices. And that's what I think a good introduction to a work has to explain to a reader of what the process is and the method is behind it. I don't know if my introduction to the last book was good enough about that, but I just now the second book, which is a follow up to We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, is now in copy editing, and I hope it's I spoke more about it there, because I continue to do these interviews until the present, and there's a sequel to that book that's also a similar narrative format is coming out hopefully next year. Okay, I didn't answer the question of my theory of midwifery. I mean, I think there's several motivations or imperatives or purposes that I'm trying to think about. One is to be able to showcase a diversity of voices. So I might have four people say similar things, but I want the book as a whole to have a certain balance of men and women, of people who are more or less educated from different parts of Syria, different religious and ethnic groups. So who gets in and who gets cut and what's presented is this balancing act of having sort of a diversity of voices. I'm also using my own judgment about the issues and the events that I think are important. So from the last book, I was like, if I were to write a typical nonfiction book about the Syrian uprising, what do I think a reader needs to know? Well, they need to know XYZ about how the regime existed. They need to know these steps and processes and major events of how things got off the ground. They need to know this topic and this topic, and they certainly need to know about Aleppo, and they need to know about Homs, and they need to know about this and that. So I was also, it was a process of me thinking through what I think is important and in some ways selecting among the voices that discussed those things. Of course, I was also learning from the interviews themselves about what was important. So it's a kind of iterative process of my knowledge of Syria that I'm building by reading lots of different works, my knowledge of Syria that I'm learning from the interviews themselves. So some selection and some this and that of ultimately, I mean, there are like probably thousands and thousands of pages of transcripts. What goes into a product that is engaging, readable, digestible, and effective for an English-speaking audience? Yeah, there's a lot of choice and lots of different things I think that I was weighing of what I felt like I wanted. A book that could, ultimately my goal was a book that could explain the story of Syria to a new audience that doesn't have any background and express something of the human dimension of what it has been like to live the Syrian conflict and do it through the material I'd collected. That's what I tried to do. And somebody else could have worked with the same material and maybe put together a very different book.
That's exactly what I was going to ask about. So, and I want to start doing this more frequently, not just with the people here, but thinking more broadly.
Yeah.
I want to write this blog post as like, to X, I bequeath my data. Because I'm just kind of like, I'm just imagining all the material that you have that you did not use.
Right.
And I know as a community, we're discussing this, but I don't think we discuss it enough. But I'm just kind of like, the Proman Syrian archive is like, you know, where would that be? Or like, where do you fall on this? It's like, I'm never going to show any of my stuff to anybody type of thing, or I'm going to make it available for a select group of individuals. But I'm just kind of like, I'm now on this thing. I'm just like, okay, if you want to see my imprint on this material, that means that you get some idea of what this background stuff was that I had access to And I'm working with some group that I got some of the information from in Northern Ireland, and they're going to set up a community evaluation committee that, with my assistance, will help figure out exactly who gets access to the raw material. But I'm just kind of curious about, this is the first time I've done this, so Jesse's kind of like, what are you talking about? But I'm kind of like now in this issue of trying to figure out how we get there on this transparency, get ourselves out of the way type of thing, let people have access to the raw material. Thoughts on this? They don't have to be, you don't have to address it at all, but I'm just curious.
No, I've been thinking about this since the start. So I would love to talk to you about it, Christian, because it sounds like you are really, there are so many complexities and costs and benefits and risks involved. And it is so delicate and so sensitive. On the one hand, this data should, I mean, not only for other researchers, but I think primarily for other, for Syrians, this, I mean, I've spent over a decade collecting Syrian stories. These should not stay on my computer. Nobody had any access. It's an absolute, I mean, this is the patrimony of the Syrian people on the one hand. On the other hand, this is still a live conflict. And people, especially because people I talked to had left the country and may have spoken with a certain amount of freedom because they'd left the country. Some of these people may have gone back. They might go back. Their families are still there. The situation is utterly changing every day, and it is still violent. So on the other hand, I have a primary responsibility that nobody in any way gets hurt by me sharing the raw data. And until now, I have been basically paralyzed between these two competing imperatives. I just haven't figured out a way to reconcile. So I love that you are thinking creatively about that. It's not that there, maybe the choice isn't share everything, not share anything, but there's some other way. So I went to the Oral History Association conference a few years back and had several conversations with archivists there because I was like, I don't even know how to begin, think about it. And what struck me then, and this was now several years ago, but these are archivists whose like entire, you know, life purpose is to create open archives for people. They're professional archivists in university libraries and so forth. And they said, at this point, given the risks, I wouldn't think about something like an archive. But
yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I'd be going to them.
I find
them to be overly risk averse. And they're generally not the people that are out in the field collecting stuff either, or have the contact with them. I think some of their interests are different, but quick intervention.
But thank you. That's good to tell, because maybe I was too influenced by them because they scared me. That thought. And of course, there's the whole, you know, the whole Boston College, you know, issue with like, I could tell like it had a totally chilling effect. Everybody was referencing, you know, you're in Boston College. So I'm not sure, but I haven't worked on it. You haven't worked on it yet, but it remains something that I know should be done. There's got to be some way to figure it out. But I can say another thing that's been interesting is with the last book, anyone I interviewed whose work I used in the book, and I'm still in contact with, I went back to them and showed them the narrative that I had and said, you know, I interviewed you several years ago. This is my edited version of your transcript, as will approve if you're in the book, you know, edited for this or for that. You'd make it readable. Because the way people speak and what is intelligible in writing is very different. I mean, I've been talking for like a half an hour now. Have I used a punctuation mark? I don't think so. Like this is one 45.
Several.
This is one 45-minute run-on sentence. So as you guys know, you transcribe that and you're like, oh my God, how do I make this readable? So there's editing for various things, as well as condensing and cutting some piece that goes well with other people's pieces. So everybody it was in contact with, I went back and showed them and got their permission. With the new books that I've just been finishing, which is all about Syrian stories of home and the meaning of home, there are fewer voices. There are 38 as opposed to like 85. And they're much longer introspective narratives. People are much more private, are talking about things that are much more personal. It's not chronicling the events of the uprising as much as people really thinking about their lives and what gives them meaning and belonging. So I really thought it was important for this one to go back to people and show the narrative that I ended up using and get their permission. It was extremely telling. There was, you know, one person I interviewed in 2000, 2017. I went back to her this summer and showed her what she'd said. And she said, "Oh my God, I'm so embarrassed. I can't believe I said that. Did I really say that? Please don't use it in the book." And I was like, okay, that's telling. Those pages thrown out. Somebody else also wanted to withdraw. Other people said, "This one sentence, can you please eliminate it? Because I think it might make my mother angry if I word it in this way." These are her words. But when you say something in the context of an interview and then it's written down, and then you see it 4 or 5 years later, and you think about how your family might see it or whatever. So we're not only thinking about the political risks, are people going to get thrown in jail by a dictatorship? But the personal, is this going to embarrass me with my family? Or I don't know if I've changed. So there are all sorts of issues. I mean, of course, political, you know, physical safety is paramount, but we also have to think about, you know, do we want to have something that the interlocutor would later find really embarrassing? Or they don't, you know, even anonymize, as much as you can anonymize things, think no one's really ever totally anonymous. Or rarely going to be anonymous, depending on the social setting. So there's a lot to consider. I spent the whole summer chasing down 38 people and trying to get them to look at line by line to make sure they would be pleased with it before it went into a book. And that was enormously time consuming and led to all sorts of edits that I never would have anticipated as being problematic. The person himself was like, "I don't want that in print." So all this kind of gives pause when it goes to putting raw data out there. On the other hand, the Wendy Perlman data should not, like, you know, be in my computer with no one else to see. And I know it makes you guys, Raiders of the Lost Archive, like, it pains you to think of so much data not being accessible to people. So I haven't figured out how to reconcile all those competing imperatives, but I know that I need to. I know that it has to be.
We're not fishing for the right answer here. I mean, on the very first podcast that we did, I admitted to destroying a bunch of data because I couldn't answer some of these questions myself. I mean, it's just, these are really tough. Like, I really want to stay on the security of data, but we have limited time. So I'm going to try to bring us back to the field work aspect of the podcast. We've talked about how when you as the curator or midwife were, engaged in this process, you're thinking hard about the disciplining of ethics and the disciplining of wanting to be true to your subjects and their representations of the world. You've talked about the disciplining effect of a market because you have an English-speaking market of people who you want to actually read this thing. Right. And this isn't a question we normally ask, but I noticed that what's missing from this set of filters for you is the disciplining effect of your discipline, which is political science. Yeah, well, so you are trained as a political scientist. In what ways does your discipline actually contribute to your filter or your midwifery or your ethos as an artist? How does political science change you as the author?
What wonderful questions. I think that came most to the fore really with Recross to Bridge and It Trembled. I mean, there I thought of almost every chapter as being guided by political questions that I could phrase in a more generalizable social science puzzle type of way of, how does an authoritarian, what explains authoritarian regime durability? Classic poli-sci question. That was chapter one. That was stories of Hafez al-Assad. And then what are the regime survival strategies that regime, what explains authoritarian updating and how regimes change over time with changing market conditions and other imperatives? That was chapter two when we moved from Hafez al-Assad to Bashar al-Assad, who took over in the year 2000. What explains social movements, protest movements, revolutions? That was the chapter on the start of the uprising and so on. What explains militarization of, under what conditions does nonviolent protest become violent? That was a chapter on the militarization of the rebellion. So there were social science and political science questions that almost every chapter sought to answer, but through a collection of Syrians simply talking about their own lived experience. Political science was also, in terms of, there's so many different stories. Somebody could have, as we were saying before, somebody could have taken the same material and told a story about gender or told a story about religion, or told a story about social forms, or about intergenerational state change. So a sociologist or an anthropologist or various cultural studies people put the same material and told a different story. That first book was a political story. It was the story of the political conflict. And political science questions were totally in the back of my own mind about deciding what is important here. What are the important questions? What are the important things a reader should learn? That was, for me, informed by political science. The second book, not so much so. I think I saw a two-finger.
Yeah, I'm related to this midwifery thing, and I'm always like mid-husbanding. I'm just like, I want to find the neutral phrase for it. But
curation might we'll go back to that.
So what I like about this is, just as you said it, right? The same raw material could be used for a different purpose.
Yeah.
What I think would be interesting is if, okay, I don't want to write this other book, but I do know that this other topic is covered in there. Let me find someone who would like to look at the raw material to do that. And then I work with them, with my group, to see if they're okay with this person revisiting this material with that in mind. I've never heard of anyone do that, but I'm just like, that becomes less of a waste for me that something's sitting on your computer or something like that. Someone's getting access to it. There's still this degree of cultivation of security, and they'll have a relationship with this new person, but it's just like the material just won't be sitting someplace to be wasted or destroyed. And I think in a sense, we're doing an injustice to this person opening up their lives and giving us all these opinions. And then we use the sliver that we're going to use for our particular project. And the rest of that information they gave us, the rest of that sacrifice, the rest of that time is completely freaking wasted. This is, seems less wasteful. So I think we've just come up with a solution for a way to do it that's other than, okay, let me just make it available to everybody. It's a cultivation, much more secure, but very nice. But okay, yeah, my question.
I just want to sort of add in there, though, I think it's still delicate because the person who gave consent to interview me was the person who gave consent to be interviewed by me was being interviewed by me for the purposes that I described and asking for the interview.
That's why it's essential that you now return with this other person in mind to be like, hey, I had this other idea. Because just like the snowball went in one direction, right? It's just like, oh, you should talk to so-and-so. This is different. You're doing the same thing. You're offering a research snowball. It's just like, hey, I have this other person that you should talk to. And here's why. And actually, you might not need to talk to them if you can't, but if you could authorize access, then so a reverse snowball.
That's
whatever.
That's great.
Yes.
As long as the original interviewee is sort of, you re-get consent for that new usage. That's a great solution. That's super
precise. But my question was, what would you advise others going forward? We normally end with this, and this seems like we come up with a bunch of stuff that I think is really fascinating, but what would you advise others who are engaging in similar kind of archival efforts? What's the nugget or two that you think is essential for them, or your credo? What is that?
Maybe a few points. One is talk to anyone and everyone you can that you have time, resources, and energy for, because you just never know what gems you can find. Personally, I like interviews that are totally open-ended. I have no list of questions, as I said, besides tell me about yourself. And then I feel like my job is to listen extremely carefully for what seem to be these little hits of gold that someone might sort of drop. And then I think of it as a person talking along, and I sort of press stop every so often and say, tell me more about that. That, like, between tell me about yourself and tell me more, what did you mean by that, or like the only questions you need. So I think that I'm just a fan of interviews that are more open-ended as opposed to more structured. To sort of be on the things that we've been talking about here, personally, I think I still haven't figured out quite sort of theory of consent for interviews, and especially interviews on sensitive topics, or what you know, quote unquote sensitive topics or vulnerable peoples. But I can say my experience of going back to people years later, asking, sort of re-seeking for permission and approval for what I ended up putting in a book and publishing, has given me pause in that I absolutely had consent to do the interview originally. But what people say and what people feel comfortable saying at one point of time might be different than what they feel comfortable being used in a research purposes later. Now, this creates almost unending dilemmas for us as researchers. It is not always feasible to go back to every single person you interviewed and ask permission to use a quotation here or there, or this is just totally not feasible as researchers. We in some ways have to go on initial consent. And I had conversations with Syrians I interviewed for this book were telling me, don't go back and seek my consent and seek other people's consent. Are you crazy? They told you it was okay to interview you. They knew the tape recorder was there. But so I don't know if there's a single right answer to this, but I think it is worth thinking about. Some people think about consent as a series of consent points over time, as opposed to some initial like barrier you get lifted and then is lifted and you go forward and don't have to think about it again. I guess this is not advice as much as hoping that we as a field, especially in doing research on these types of difficult topics, have critical conversations and creative thinking about what consent really, what it means and how to do it ethically.
I completely concur. I mean, one of the things that I think a lot of those, you know, the conversations that take place under the broad banner of transparency, you know, that, you know, they could really benefit from thinking about a transparent and long-term ongoing relationship with subjects, you know, through revisits to the same population. Because I think that's the way that other disciplines do it. But I think political science is oftentimes much more one-stop shopping, much more extractive, and we kind of have to calibrate the advice that we put in our papers and, you know, discuss in our practices manual for that reality, that a lot of graduate students are trying to make good use of their third year funding and they kind of want to go to a refugee camp. And actually, they're not sure if they're going to go back to that refugee camp. So we're trying to get best practices, you know, on the record for what those 25-year-olds ought to do. But that's quite different than what you're discussing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, an apples and oranges thing. I don't know where we're going to wrap up in terms of timing, but I do want to ask you a question in terms of, like, in the spirit of that intervention, teaching. You know, so when you come to teaching fieldwork to people who haven't done this before, and particularly I like to ask the question in the following way, how would you advise someone to do this kind of work if they didn't speak the language, which a lot of people want to do, even if they shouldn't, they want to. So that wasn't you, but I know that you have students for whom it is true. So what do you tell them?
Oh, this is a tough one. And this was interesting. I mean, it sort of reminds me of Christian's earlier question about sort of almost like reputation and sort of like the cred in order to get people to talk and or feel like you were worth talking to in the first place. I couldn't imagine having done this project if I didn't speak Arabic. My Arabic has gotten pretty rusty over the years, but the people I was trying to talk to, the fact that like you could see that someone had dedicated years and years and years to learning the language and could converse in it and could do interviews in the language was absolutely the most important, I think, first step of credibility that they should give me.
Language first, everything else second. Is that really the advice that you give graduate students?
No, I'm just saying that it reminded me this question of sort of the reputational effects of access.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, honestly, because I've never done work with a translator or a fixer. As I said, like Abu Thayer took me over as under my wing and introduced me to people, but it wasn't a formal research relationship as much as a friendship and a political project for him. Sorry, I'm stumped, which is hard because I haven't gotten this question from.
You haven't gotten this question from your own students yet.
They're scared. Come on.
I can see why. I can see why. You're pretty intimidating, Wendy.
What I find interesting is that so Jesse and I differ on this one, right? He's got some language proficiencies. I'm just like, I got my blackness, right? I'm just like, I'm sorry. I'm cashing in on that. I'm in an environment. I'm just like, okay, yo, look, we can go to some rural location, but I'm gonna need somebody to help me with this. but I'm pulling out everybody who's got some English that doesn't like some authoritarian leader or some repressive agent, and they're going to talk to me because I'm a Black person, or I work with folks that were in Northern Ireland on one side, or I work with the Dalit in another location, or soon like the Roma. I'm just like, you know, so that's my cred, that's my reputation. Now I'm missing out on some stuff because I, you send me to some like really, really rural location where they have no English whatsoever. I'm just like, oh, I'll just follow British imperialism. They're speaking English. So, you know, it's like, so we end up in these zones where we're comfortable and people start kind of talking to you. And I find that to be interesting, but similar to Wendy's way. I mean, so I guess from that perspective, I'm just like, I'm historically invested in the oppressed, and thus having spent that time or having had that experience, then folks will come out. And I think that's quite interesting. Related to an earlier point though, before it goes, like, I don't know if you've read like the slave narratives of the people in the United States post-slavery, but I'm just like, I don't think we would do those now, given our concerns with ethics. And yes, this might have been traumatizing. It probably was traumatizing to folks at the time. But boy, what insights were provided from what took place from having done those things? And I'm just kind of like, yeah, maybe we should not have traumatized them at that moment. But damn, given every effort to taken to hide slavery and so forth, and the horrors and contained within it, those narratives are like the gift that keeps on giving in terms of historical awareness and knowledge about what happened and what should happen to this day. So,
Just
want to get that in there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but the thing, I mean, this I think is really helpful. And sorry that I pause so much on language. And I think it's because Jesse and I, we're both coming from an area studies sort of background where you have a long investment in a region of the world. But I think the important thing is to convey to interviewees that there is an investment. So, I mean, what Christian thinks, an investment in causes of justice, an investment in struggles for dignity, something that can convey, whatever can convey to these interviewees that your relationship is not merely extractive and opportunistic. You're not simply there to gather some data so that you can have a fancy career, that there is some reason that they they might want to talk to you, that comes from some place of respect. And I think in an Arab world context, demonstrating language proficiency is a very important signal of respect that in that cultural context is a really important signal, but it's not the only signal. You don't need, language is not the only way to convey, I respect you and I want to record your story and talk to you because I want to honor your experience, or I want this to serve an emancipatory aim that you also share. So I think the important thing would be to whatever tools a student has at their disposal to be able to, one, believe it, you really kind of not believe it, and communicate it, and remember that, you know, as Leanne Fuji said, nobody, you don't, it's a privilege, not a right, to enter a person's world and have them talk to you. And you've got to earn that right. You earn that right. And yeah, a language immediately came to my mind because I'm coming from a context in which it is a major way of earning that right. But it's not the only one. But earn it. And earn it.
Hello. Thank you for listening to Raiders of the Lost Archive and for writings mentioned in this podcast, as well as what we're going to be doing in the future. Please feel free to look at archiveraiders.weebly.com.